Hello, songbirds, and welcome to a special music episode of your friendly Guardian Technology podcast, Tech Weekly. We've got a phenomenally packed show for you, and I, Alex Kratosky, will play the role of conductor over the next 45 or so minutes. Yes, longer than usual, orchestrating the deep thoughts flowing from our esteemed panel of music and technology experts. It's an out-of-the-ordinary show with out-of-the-ordinary guests. Please welcome Jemima Kish, who once threatened to wear a I'm a Music Downloader t-shirt to the Brit Awards. Is that what it was, Jemima?
Yeah, 47% share files, it was to the Brits, and then I realised actually it's just full of suits getting drunk and nobody cared.
Also, our The Man representative, Fred Bolza, the Director of Strategy from Sony BMG. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
Ian Hogarth, CEO of online web gig recommendation service Songkick.
Hello.
Hello. And CEO of music news resource Gigulate, Ben Perot. Welcome very much to the pod.
Thanks very much.
My favourite technology-related music is Video Killed the Radio Star, and I'm also a big fan of things like Stereolab, and recently saw Hot Chip, who are sort of geeky, technology-based musicians. Can you share with me your most recent gig and favourite technologically music-related stuff?
My last gig was Holly Golightly, Monto Water Rats, and definitely my favourite technology-related music is Kraftwerk.
How about you, Ben?
My last gig was a trip to the Old Blue Dust in East London, and I got to see Ayn, who's a folk singer-songwriter from Ireland, and he was very good. My favourite technology-related music is probably Mouse on Mars, who like sticking crazy sounds together and making rhythms out of sneakers on a basketball court.
Fred, what are yours?
My last gig was on Saturday. I went to see Stan Tracy, also known as the godfather of British jazz, 83 years old, still going strong, plays at the last Saturday of every month at the Bull's Head in Barnes. It's very, very good music. And I, technology related, I'd have to go with a rather obscure band called Silver Apples from the late 60s, who invented their own oscillators to kind of create a sort of bizarre hybrid of West Coast psychedelia with electronic music. It was just a drum kit and some weird homemade synthesizers. It's quite odd. I strongly recommend it.
That sounds awesome. Jemima, what about yours?
I haven't been to a gig for ages. It's terrible, but it was Tom Waits. Music, probably Metronomy. They're pretty techno. I love them. And Joe's from Totnes.
Well, this episode of Tech Weekly will take a slightly different tack. For those of you who've been with us over the past year, don't expect much news or even your views. This week, we're dropping in interviews with Last.fm and Pandora and theorizing and debating the big business of musical entertainment. If you're still stuck in the 8-track days, I'd love an 8-track, to be honest. Do prepare for warp speed. Tech Weekly will guide the way. So what would you say is the biggest shift in the music industry over the past 50 years? Vinyl to cassette, CD to MP3, or free music love to DRM? I bet most industry experts would poo-poo the techs that have made music sound better and would point the finger at the digital revolution. It's the biggest thorn in the music industry's side, the ease with which people can get it for free. Is the old copyright model outdated in a world where file sharing runs rife and remixing is the new art? Fred, what is the official line on how Sony BMG is working to protect its intellectual property?
There's a couple of questions embedded in your preamble. I mean, one is the question, is copyright as it stands fit for purpose in the digital age? And there's variable answers. You know, Lawrence Lessig and the Creative Commons people take one stance. Traditional copyright owners take another stance. And the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. There are aspects of copyright which are no longer fit for purpose and aspects that are. So that leads me to the second point, which is the biggest shift of the last 50 years really isn't a technology, but it's the fact that we've moved from producing units of music to users consuming an amount of music which isn't based on units anymore. So that's very complex because it completely disintegrates the historic supply chain, which was all based about putting pieces of plastic into your hand. And so instead of bits of plastic, now it's bits of information that flow freely all over the place. So I think the consumer, the fan, is also the driver of economic value, which is very different than someone going into a shop and buying a CD. So I think that's the biggest change. And therefore, it flows that a copyright system aimed at records, CDs, or digital downloads therefore struggles to cope with some of the actual ways in which people are consuming music.
So how are you coping with that? What types of things are you putting into place to deal with some of these new issues that have cropped up?
In a number of ways, you know, the first thing you try to do is you try to license new services, and that's, you know, a fraught process, as I'm sure my esteemed colleagues here will confirm, because we're trying to find new ways of licensing, and yet we don't want to destroy our traditional business. It is still driving vast amounts of our value and our ability to reinvest in artists. So it's a complex, as my chairman always says, it's like trying to fix a plane at 35,000 feet. So you can't just take the wings off and put on new ones. You have to kind of do it a little bit differently. The second thing is we're working with the government and with the ISPs through the Memorandum of Understanding process to see if there's ways in which we can adapt the infrastructure, both in terms of policy and legal frameworks, as well as technological infrastructure, to make some kind of impact on the system itself.
How do you see copyright and some of the business models limiting the creativity of music development? What would you say, Ian?
I certainly see it in, you know, the businesses we work with, just in the fact that, you know, they get sued and they go out of business, like Muxtape, for example. I mean, that was a very creative idea and, you know, that was shut down, what, last week? So, I mean, that's probably the strongest limit of all, that you can't operate your business anymore because of sort of legal ramifications.
Interestingly, it wasn't that the Muxtape idea in itself was illegal. It's just that because his idea was linking together a collection of songs and then not necessarily, you know, actually physically copying them anywhere. But
right.
That's what other people did off the back of his site, and that's where he got into trouble.
Right, exactly.
I think for us, our business, it was a conscious decision. I'm sure it was the same with Ian, to steer right away from all of the kind of copyright issues and to develop a business which could work within the frameworks of the music industry, but actually completely ignore the kind of thorny issue of recorded music, because it really is actually just a subset of the overall music industry.
I think the way this has evolved, really, technology and the web especially has empowered music fans to create music services they personally wanted. So, for example, my friends at SeekPod, they had search engine technology, so they built like a way to search the web for playable music. Anthony from The Hype Machine, he wanted a way to listen to music blogs in aggregate form, so he built The Hype Machine. Justin from Muxtape wanted a way to put mixtapes online, so he built Muxtape. And that's, you know, three examples of, you know, individuals or very small teams of, you know, developers who love music making stuff that they wanted. And that just completely clashed with the way that, you know, music services operated in the past, which is institutions rather than as individuals. So I think it's really the clash of those two kind of forces.
One last question. Fred, I wanted to find out from you how, now that music is being given away in packages and bundles, et cetera, for free in so many different places, how can the industry charge or sue or even have some kind of legal recompense when it is being distributed so much?
Well, again, this is what I was alluding to before. We have to think perhaps much more like an internet service provider or a telco does, which is every fan is, and forgive me for putting it crudely, but in the end one has to run a business, which is a number of pounds a month times a number of months. And that month may be their entire life. Who knows? So perhaps the issue is all of these systems that are described are the ones where we're not able to charge a percent of a dealer price. Now, if the dealer price is zero, a percent of zero is zero, so the whole system falls down completely. And I think what you're seeing with subscription models now and these kind of keep your favorite style bundles, which are enabled by a move towards format-free music, is a big thing, because it was like subscribing to The Economist, and then when you canceled your subscription, someone knocks on your front door and says, right, I'm having all the back issues. So I think we're going to have to look at models which don't look at remunerating a unit anymore. And therefore, you can then bundle it in with a monthly charge. Could be an ISP charge, could be your phone bill, could be whatever. And I think that's the other problem, is it's not going to be one thing. It's going to be up to the fan to decide what they prefer. So the challenge is the value of music, as high as ever. The price of music, a unit of music, zero. The value is somewhere in between, and we just have to be clever about how we find it.
Well, this actually leads quite nicely into what we're going to be talking about in just a second. It seems that new models for money-making are yet to be devised. So next up, we find out what they are and how people are still making cash from the industry.
Carl
cast your mind back a few hundred years to Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. After all, he was the one that started it all. These days, we think of his incredible symphonies, his sonatas, his concertos, but they weren't the only gifts that he left for the rest of us. He also set a template for a few other things we take for granted these days. After all, like any good rock and roll star, he died young. Mozart was just 34 when the rheumatic fever got him, and like Tupac, Nick Drake or Kurt Cobain, he made far more money after he died than before, particularly when his wife Constanza cashed in by selling off his manuscripts and holding memorial gigs. Now that leads to the next part of his legacy. After all, until then, there'd never been that much interest in sheet music. Mozart's fame was so enormous, though, that people wanted to copy the music he'd written. So for the next 100 years, that's how things worked. You'd write a tune, you'd sell the sheet music. Welcome to the music industry. Now fast forward another 100 years from Mozart, and a couple more great shifts happened. First, boffins discovered that you could record music onto bits of wax or vinyl and play it back. And then some clever bugger invented radio. Suddenly, you didn't have to rely on your mate's dodgy renditions of great songs anymore. You could just get it over the air or listen to it in your home. Now, just imagine today how incredible that change was back then, and how unsettling it must have been if you were one of the sheet music publishers. Now, a few things happened over the next 100 years, but the music industry stayed more or less the same. Broadcasting songs, putting out records. Things got bigger, they consolidated, and now we've got four companies controlling nearly 3/4 of all the music that's sold around the world. So the reason we went over this little history lesson was to give things a bit of perspective. Right now, we hear a lot about the internet, downloading, file sharing, and the dangers that it all poses to the music industry. But you have to realise that sort of talk's nothing new. Every 100 years or so, there's a big technological change, and it's a bit scary for whoever's stuck in the middle of it. The music industry, as we know it, isn't some kind of grand institution. Even the legendary record labels like Columbia and RCA aren't much more than a century old. And if they want to survive, they need to come up with new ideas, just like Constanza did, and just like the sheet music publishers had to. After all, even if the music business changes, music itself is still pretty much the same as it ever was. Fans keep enjoying their favourite tunes, composers keep writing songs, and wild young things gifted with talent keep playing their hearts out and hoping that they die before they get old. Now that's the music industry that Mozart was part of, and even the internet can't change it that much.
It feels like they've tried everything already, but the pirates still sail the file-sharing seas. Yet the industry is still afloat. How are they making their dough? Well, thank goodness for the creative teams who are thinking up new and fun ways to get your money out of your pockets and into theirs. More gigging, more merchandise, more bundles. It's good for you, right? So, Fred, can you talk a little bit more about some of the innovative ways that Sony are using?
It's about, I guess, in some instances, about diversification. So for a long time, the music industry, and more specifically the major labels, took a very conservative view of what they would and wouldn't license. And again, we found ourselves in positions where, in fact, the licensing conditions were crippling the ability for a startup to launch. And in some cases, in the case of YouTube or Last.fm, they made the, some would argue, brave, some would argue perilous decision to go without the license, then get bought before, and then get sued later. So the challenge is how to make these models work in an open enough licensing framework. But yeah, we're working down. We've licensed ad-funded models this year, which we'd never licensed before, things like We7. We licensed Nectar's loyalty scheme. We're licensing music in games. You know, we're even looking at possibly developing games based on some of our bands as characters in the games themselves. So there's all sorts of things that you can do. I mean, some of them will work, some of them will fail, some will be incredibly cool, some will be super naff. But I think we just have to stick our neck out and try.
From an outsider's perspective, it's changed quite a lot, certainly in the last few months. We were at a time, until very recently, where we felt like we had to kind of innovate outside the system in order to create something that was tenable. So as kind of people who wanted to innovate and create something unique, one of two things would probably fail. Either there would be a kind of a case for litigation, or you might end up in a situation where you couldn't create a viable business model just because of the revenues that you had to pay out.
Ian, what are some of the more successful models?
I have a slightly naive way of looking at this, which is from the fan's perspective rather than from the industry's perspective. And I'll pay for something that feels unique and special to me as a fan of a band. So, you know, 200 years ago, there wasn't a recorded music industry, right? So the only thing I could do as a unique experience was to go to see them live. And then the recorded music industry came out. I remember the, you know, excitement. I'd go down to the record store. But with, you know, with MP3s, it became less exciting. You know, the experience of going to iTunes and paying 75 cents for an MP3 just doesn't feel unique or exciting because I can stream it for free somewhere else. Whereas, you know, a T-shirt or going to a gig, that feels like a unique experience. So I think it's just about the way you can make money out of music fans by giving them something unique. So I see, you know, live and merch and kind of custom primo kind of recorded music being the main areas to make money.
Streaming music is a really interesting thing to look at there, because you've already sort of admitted to me earlier that you tend to listen to music streamed for free. What is really the future then for buying digital music if there are so many services offering stream?
My instinct is that there isn't really that strong a case to be made for people spending a lot of money on recorded music in the next 20 years. The British Managers Forum did a little survey where they looked at musicians' incomes from recorded music, live and merchandise. And like in 2000, it was two-thirds of the income coming from recorded and a third coming from live and merch. And now in 2007, it was two-thirds coming from live and merch and a third coming from recorded. So, you know, there's a very strong trend going on where live is booming, merch is booming, publishing is booming, but recorded is very strongly in decline. So instinctively, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of money to be made there for me. In terms of where artists make their money, they get a better percentage of the sale on a gig ticket than they do on a CD, right? Just talking to my friends who are in bands and looking at the data from Polestar and people like that, you know, you can make very, very substantial money on the road right now. Whereas I don't hear about anyone apart from like large scale catalog, you know, people like the Beatles, etc., making a lot of money from recorded right now.
And what about the people that are more behind the scenes, like the songwriters? Do they still make enough money from the trend towards live music? I have a very good friend who had a number one in the Far East for 57 weeks and she made 13 grand from that because there was so much piracy that, you know.
I think that's actually a really thorny question, which is how does a musician who doesn't want to tour and doesn't have merch make money if they can't make money off recording? I don't have an answer for that. I think it's probably in some sort of premium subscription model for the music, but I think it's a really, really difficult question to answer.
What this points to is that there's a huge amount of different kinds of artists who want to have different kinds of careers, who want to get different things out of their participation in the music industry. We also have to segment our artists. So not everyone wants to be Leona Lewis. And the question then is, how do you become viable? So I think what needs to happen is that there needs to be also an education process towards the artist, because if you're part of the Performing Rights Society, if you're a songwriter that doesn't actually perform, you can get money from the performance of other songs. So I think there's a lot of ignorance also as to how people can make money out of their own artistic and creative careers. And it's because it's been so complicated. I've often heard said, if we had a white sheet of paper, we'd never design a music industry that looks like this. And the result is actually maybe we are in a kind of year zero. We are being given a much blanker piece, or someone's been furiously erasing anyway. So it's blanker than it's ever been. And I think to the streaming point earlier, to some extent, streaming is like radio. You don't pay for radio, but you do. You pay. It's ad funded. It's the daddy of all ad funded models.
Isn't it the case though that, you know, revenue from radio has been in decline as well?
Well, exactly. But at some point, all of those ad dollars that currently sit in these not very targeted push environments like newspapers, no offense, and billboards and stuff like that come onto the web where you can actually get much better return on your marketing investment. When that happens and the CPMs start to come up, I think then you'll start to see that happening. The problem is it just hasn't happened yet. A page in the New York Times is still worth more to a media buyer than some banner ads on MySpace or wherever.
Right.
How can this be in the time when Google made so much money out of the long tail? This is another thing we were just talking about just before we started recording.
The record label still holds a cachet. We can argue about the value of recorded music because I think it is declining. But ultimately, the romantic notion, I mean, you know, we've done lots to kind of reestablish the Columbia and RCA brands as kind of Columbia's The Clash, Miles Davis, you know, Bob Dylan. And people signed for that reason. The Ting Tings, for instance, they signed for that reason. So the record label still holds something. The question is, it now has to do something with that cachet as opposed to just assume that it's billions of records will get sold.
Yeah. I mean, I really like the Columbia website. I think it's really cool the way you've got the disc spinning and you can go in. It feels very like a romantic experience going on that site. Actually, I do like it a lot. But I think that, you know, when I've been talking to labels, everybody is saying this thing D2C, you know, direct to consumer. We want to get the band marketing direct to the consumer. And all the labels are saying that, but what they're forgetting is the fact that, well, if it really is direct to consumer, then there is no label involved, right? It's band to the fan, right? Which is an interesting paradigm given everyone in the labels is currently talking about D2C. And one thing that I've noticed that's interesting is brands going direct to the artist. So a classic example is like, you know, brands associating themselves with live, like what Bacardi did with the Groove Armada tour, what, you know, the O2 have done with the O2 Arena, Carling Academies, all of this brand sponsorship of either tours or live-related events. So, for example, last year, $1 billion was spent by brands sponsoring artist tours. And that really is, in many ways, D2C. It's the brand affiliating themselves directly with the artist to reach the consumer.
It's kind of an interesting set, and I think it's partly because because there's so much more revenue coming through from merchandise and from the live music scene, then labels represent sort of a smaller proportion of it and can command less, I guess, as far as the management companies are concerned. So they're going out and making these decisions for themselves. And you're seeing other companies spring up as well, which are representing the artists in different ways. So Live Nation, for example, who have decided to take more of a, you know, forward step and try and pick up artists like Madonna and try and do a bit more with them. And yeah, they're involving labels and involving their expertise, but you are seeing this kind of move where those artists and the kind of big brands, as you say, are kind of finding ways of making some cash together, and sometimes it's cutting the label out of the loop.
It's interesting to see the sort of diffusion of this, of the money, and how it is spreading out more and more thinly. But the danger is, of course, at the minute we're witnessing, you know, the crunch, as you know, as has been threatened. And so what effect do you think that will have?
I've heard that live music is a pretty robust through recessions because it's something people find quite hard to give up. But I certainly think people are going to stop spending like $1,000 on Madonna tickets. But I think there'll be a lot more kind of, I don't think local live music will suffer that badly.
It's interesting, actually, you say that because on the Games blog, Keith Stewart, who writes there, asked the same question about games. When will the credit crunch affect your desire to buy a game? Exact same response from the fans. They said, well, we'll stop going out for meals. We'll stop buying new clothing. We will still go with our entertainment.
Interestingly, though, I've heard that, you know, people are still spending their £35 on a game because it represents really good value because you get this kind of repeat experience, right? Yeah. Live music's the opposite in that you get the experience once and therefore it's seen as the opposite of being frugal and that you're going out and getting something that's really good and high valued. But you only get to enjoy it once. Whereas something like buying an album might be considered a repeat experience kind of thing, which you can spend money on. I wonder whether it might mitigate some of the declines in revenues. It's a pretty big trend to try and push against. But whether it's going to
there's something interesting happening there. There's a couple of companies in the UK. One called Concert Live, another one called like Be Here Now, Be Here Live, or something like that. And what they do is they record the concert as it's happening, and then they sell you the CD as you're going out the door, so you do have a lasting kind of engagement with that experience you've just had. And I think that's an area where the record labels will see significant growth because live catalogue, for example, will become more and more important.
The challenge is the challenge is a contractual one. You often don't own the live rights. Here we get into a thorny side of what rights do you acquire at the point of signing the artist,
right?
And the sound recording rights don't necessarily. I mean, that's where I think your point is absolutely right. You know, all this talk about 360 models, I mean, I always say 360, if you think about it, is the same as zero. So if you're trying to drive value in all the revenue streams that affect an artist, the only place you can do it from is from a management perspective because you're the person that's the custodian of all the artist's interest. So I think there's a huge problem about that. But I agree, there's ways to add value to the experience. And I think that's the underlying impact of the credit. We're just going to have to try a lot harder to add value back to the experience so that people prefer it. Because music is important and it's a brilliant product. And, you know, I always say when you go to a party and you say, I'm in the music industry, everyone gives you an earful about, oh, you're screwed and this is going to happen and this is shit and blah, blah, blah. And but everyone's got an opinion. If you say, I work for Unilever, they're like, great, okay, see you later. So, I mean, the thing is, it's a very powerful product and there's no doubt about that. But we perhaps have lost the ability to inject, forgive the corniness of the expression, but some magic. The romantic image of walking home with a clutch of LPs under your arm, which show the world how cool you are, is gone because it's embedded in something which is inside your pocket.
Right.
So we have to find ways of doing that. And I think the credit crunch will, so to speak, will force us to hone that ability. We really need to relearn how to market in a completely new context.
People do that coolness thing in a different way nowadays. It might be T-shirts or badges or whatever.
Or just listening to music really loud on the bus on your mobile
phone. Don't you just hate that? Why do they do that?
Well, the good news is that the music fan is still at the center of the universe. Rest assured, you won't be cut out of the loop yet. In fact, you are now the most important part of it all. Next up, we're looking at the new ways in which you are changing the ways we all consume our tunes. If Dylan can go electric, why can't the music business go digital? We asked a professional songwriter and musician, Helianne Lindvall, to tell us in an ideal world how a digital music business would operate.
The internet has made life easier for me as a musician and songwriter. Because of the internet, I can now work with other songwriters and musicians in other countries. It's immediate, meaning I can work across borders with friends on the same track at the same time. Also, as an independent musician, it has made it a lot easier to promote my music. But at the same time, it's taken away the livelihood of a lot of my musician friends. Illegal downloading and lack of control over copyrights has led to friends losing their publishing deals. And they are very hard to come by. So to me, in an ideal digital world, there would be an international directive for how to compensate music creators. This would value copyright and protect it. It's all very well that the music industry is fighting for extending copyrights for performers, but that would be useless if it's not respected in the digital world. Maybe the UN should have a role setting international copyright rules on the internet. I believe an international body taking care of musicians' rights would also benefit music fans. The effect would be easier access to music, with this legal alternative resulting in better sound quality. It will also make sure that people know the money they spend will actually filter down to the people who have created the tracks. With all the new ventures that are in the works, MySpace Music, Amazon's new music store, and Nokia's Comes With Music, there's no set norm. Collection societies have to negotiate separately with every single company that wants to use music on a digital platform. Nokia's Comes With Music service is set to launch this week. But these negotiations were so complex, they still didn't have an agreement in place on exactly how or what to pay the songwriters last week. The danger is that the big labels will have more clout than the independents. For instance, the majors have bought equity in MySpace new venture, leaving the independents fighting for the scraps. Yet smaller labels are vital for up-and-coming artists. My other proposal would be to levy ISP subscriptions. The resulting revenue should be distributed according to the number of downloads each track receives. In the digital world, every track has its own unique code, so it should in theory be easier to track than in the physical world. With these proposals, I intend to make the internet equal for musicians so that big corporations don't control who will and who won't make some sort of profit. Yet again.
Do you miss me?
So how do you find your new music? I personally would be lost without Last FM and of course the recommendations of a few deeply, deeply indie friends. So I wanted to move now away from the business tack into something that's a lot more consumer driven. How the net has really profoundly changed the way in which we consume and derive our musical tastes. So first, Ben, can you tell me a little bit more about your service?
So Gigulate is a business that draws together all of the kind of music information that we can find across the web and sorts it for you, and then presents it to you in a way that's palatable and easy for you to kind of get access to, and maybe even within inside of 10 seconds get a pretty good perspective of where music's at the moment.
So it's a very personalized service. And in a similar way, your service, Ian, is very, very personalized as well in terms of recommendation and expanding that out. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, well, what we do is it's kind of similar to Gigulate, but for concerts. So we just pull in all the information about concerts going on in the UK and the US, and then we look at your iTunes library, figure out what you like, and then personalize that selection of concerts for you to kind of give you an upcoming sense of what you could go to over the next few months.
Fred, listening to all of these, and I'm sure being very aware of all of these, what do you think are the real benefits of these types of services for the music industry as a whole?
Well, I think the figures, some staggering, there's 200 million pieces of recorded content floating around the world. So the analogy I always think of is, well, infinite choice is in fact equal to no choice. Completely. Because if you can't find anything, then it doesn't matter how much choice you have. When we were talking about the internet before and what it's done, is the technology has actually brought scale to bear, sheer absolute volume and scale. So whereas I used to walk into Rough Trade when I lived in Portobello and said, and they would walk in and say, ah, Fred, here's 15 CDs that we think you'll like, of which normally I would leave with 10 in my hand. And they were always right. There was no algorithm. There was just Nigel who knew what I liked. But it's the same thing. That made it manageable. Whereas I would walk into HMV on Oxford Street, and if I didn't know what I wanted, I would walk out with a migraine. So again, the underlying model, no different. All of these services help people find stuff. And helping people discover stuff then allows them to form a bond with it, and then informing a bond with it allows them to consume it. So I think these are of crucial, they're of crucial relevance, all of these services, because the thing is, and this is the flip side of the user-generated world, or the is that editorial has a value. I mean, if you sit in a newspaper, you certainly like to think so, and pretty much I consider us as editorial content. We aggregate content into easily definable and consumable chunks and then try and make sure that it goes to the right demographic. That's the marketing speak. But the reality is we're pointing people to stuff that they think will, that we think they'll like. So the more the merrier of these services, frankly, but they have to work. One crap experience and your service is dead.
So what's the future, though, if the two of you are now effectively the A&R guys? if you're developing those models that will help to aggregate, that will help to direct people, that will be, you know, the Sony BMGs, those people who help to support and direct what people want to consume.
We're not really the A&R guys. We're more the kind of replication of your friend on the street or the other editorial product you could get. So, you know, all we're doing is offering another alternative to your mate down the pub who might recommend music, or Fred's guy down at the local record shop. We're just a kind of additional thing that might fit into that kind of supply of music recommendation.
And I mean, how do people then find out about the old catalogs, the back catalogs, through services like the recommendations?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, from the live perspective, one interesting trend is being all the musicians coming out of retirement to go on the road. So, you know, we had a ton of people coming to buy Tina Turner tickets and, you know, find out more about her shows.
Again, going back to Ben, it's a fantastic marketing opportunity. You know, if you like the Zootons, then you'll like whatever back catalog. You can use the front to point to the back to point to the front, and everything
Absolutely.
In between.
Yeah.
And on the A&R point, which I think is interesting, we tried an experiment, which we started about 18 months ago, which we stopped receiving physical demos, and all demos were to be submitted online. So artists would be blogging with us, and we have a team of bloggers in the A&R community, and they're talent scouting. And that's an interesting model. So instead of getting, 300 CDs that no one listened to, we got 3,000 blogs, and we actually know what the band looks like. We know what the profile of the friends are. We know who they are. And suddenly, you know, you can bottom feed the traditional A&R process in a completely different way.
Doesn't this mean, though, that your A&R process is completely different now? Because, you know, we're not talking about guys hanging out in smoky clubs, not least because people can't smoke in clubs anymore. But, you know, your scouts are kind of sitting on the computer looking at MySpace.
You need both, because, of course, the kind of people that submit a demo online often aren't the people that get signed. So there's still a lot of value in the traditional gig circuit.
Again, we're talking about the idea there's a lot of content out there. You need to have some sort of filtering of the data. It's harder for, like, you know, a few people at a record label to pick the big winners from the pack. So it's an area that's really ripe for revolution, because, you know, if you're sitting there at the A&R desk and there's a million bands out there on MySpace, you're trying to pick the next one to sign. It would be great if you had a filtered list of 1,000, say, to listen to, rather than having to go to listen to every single one, or, you know, wait till they happen to tour a show near you.
It seems surprising that Last.fm haven't engaged their massive data and almost sold it back to the record industry, or at least
used it. Well, they have in part, actually, because they have a hype chart, and that now appears in Music Week, which is a small but notable milestone.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I think the main reason that it hasn't kind of burgeoned as a sort of money creating opportunity is just because labels don't typically want to pay for it. I mean, there isn't a huge business for startups in selling data back to the label, because there's only four of them. If they pay, you know, $500,000 a year, that's $2 million in revenue. It's not that substantial an opportunity for, you know, for example, the sort of startup the VCs want to back. So, you know, I think that the data will be used more by the fans, actually, and the labels are responding to fan intent. So, for example, the Hype Machine is a perfect example of this. The number of people in A&R I talk to who use the Hype Machine as a discovery process, what the Hype Machine does is it filters opinion from, say, 1,500 different music bloggers who are not, you know, professional music journalists, and it bubbles that up and says these are the top five bands being discussed on blogs right now, and the labels are all over that top five using it as a potential, you know, signing process.
So we've deconstructed the modern and a little bit of the past. Next up, it's time to do a bit of future gazing. We've already mentioned the powers of recommendation and discovery that the great Last.fm offers. And it was for this reason that Jemima and Bobby Johnson asked founder Martin Stixel to come into the pod to talk about the service. They started off by talking about the free streaming that the site now offers and asked Martin to explain how they managed to persuade the labels to let them offer on-demand audio on the site.
I think it's really been a long history. First and foremost, that with Last.fm, we always tried to do the right thing. Other sites maybe didn't really take copyright issues so serious at Last.fm, and that created a lot of goodwill for us in the industry when we eventually got down to the negotiation with the record labels. Having said this, it still took us quite a long time. But I think the music industry now is open to experimenting with new revenue streams. They see that the normal business of selling plastic discs doesn't really work anymore. Download sales are kind of flat. So they're really looking at new ways to making music, to making money out of music. Also now we monetize music through advertising, which is really an old model. I mean, it's been done with radio all these years. But it's only in this form now, in online, with display advertising next to it.
When I'm listening to music on my computer, I don't actually look at the player very much. I don't look at, even if I'm playing it off a web page, I'm looking at other pages. Do people click that much on those adverts?
They do click. And I think what we have done is we made these listening pages so attractive, with a lot of information surrounding the music that you're currently listening to, that you always find yourself coming back and looking at it. You want to see a photo of the artist playing, or the album cover, or want to read a short biography, or want to find out what the next concert is going to be like, or what other people have to say about these artists. So we really try to balance content with advertising.
Can you tell me what the negotiations were like with the record companies? And obviously you had a lot of the indie labels on to start with, and they're more willing to sort of experiment, I suppose. But how did you put that forward to the big labels, and how did they react?
When we started out Last.fm, we tried to approach them in about 2002, 2003, and they were simply not ready to embrace the online world at all. It was only really in the last 18 months that they have finally come around to seeing the internet, and more specifically Last.fm as a force for good, because they could see that we were promoting music, we were keeping all their music in circulation. They could also see that we didn't trample copyright with our feet. That really helped us, both of these things. So we're really romancing and charming the music. We are not just a cold technical delivery service. We give all the surrounding information that makes music really special and really interesting also to our users. And they liked it.
And also, I mean, it can't have hurt that you're not an independent organization anymore. You know, there's a lot of money behind you and a big American media firm.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, being a startup, some business partners and also all sorts of other people are not entirely sure how long you're going to be around for. So now with the stability of a strong bigger brother around, I think they're much more eager to work with us, and they know that we're serious and that we're here for the long haul, really.
How does working with them actually work, though? Because obviously they're kind of predominantly based in the US. I mean, how autonomous are you?
We're pretty autonomous. I mean, we all stayed here in London. We expanded our team. We doubled our office size recently. They know that we know how to run websites, that we know how our community and how our platform works, and they're not really interfering with this. We're working with them on a number of fronts. They obviously ask us about other things as well. They want to know like what they should do with the other internet properties, and we can give them some sort of consultancy and advice on a couple of things. But we're concentrating mainly on Last.fm and making this into the success that it will be.
So I think put some new media brains on the CBS body?
To a certain extent. Yeah. I think they were definitely interested in our input and what they could learn from our systems and our mechanisms to apply to other assets that they have.
Recommendation seems to be kind of the next generation of online sites, and we're seeing more and more business models around this. Are there any other sort of sites using that same sort of principle that you've been keeping an eye on?
Not really, not in the extent that we are doing it. I mean, services like Amazon were doing similar things all along, but on a much more limited level. Any offering on the internet that deals with a lot of content cannot really afford to be without recommendation. But having said this, I think what we also realized is that recommendation is a sort of like slightly advanced feature.
So the kind of elephant in the room, really, in all this is Apple. You know, they run the, or even some might say monopolize, the music business online. What happens if, for example, we've seen they're moving to streaming video, and, you know, they deliver video rental now. What happens if they move into delivering audio in the same way? Because that screws your business in a major way, doesn't it?
I mean, Last.fm has always been much broader than just, I don't know, selling downloads or streaming music to people. I think there's a whole community around it. That sometimes a lot of our members don't even listen to music. They're just about like finding out about music, seeing what other people have listened to. Having said that, obviously, if Apple does something like this, it's going to be an interesting competition. But they don't really have all this information surrounding music that we have. All these artist biographies, photos, journal posts, similar artist texts. I mean, I could go on here for quite a while. They don't really have any of that. It would be interesting to see, but they would only really do this if it helps them sell more hardware products, which you could sort of like see happening with the iPhone Touch, the iPod Touch and the iPhone. We'll see what happens. I don't know. A bit of competition is always great for the users.
It's good you say that as well, because I imagine the record labels that you've just been talking about making a deal with, they're quite keen to see competitors to iTunes. In fact, we know they're desperate to see competitors to iTunes. So how much easier does negotiation become? Because you can say, hey, deal with us. We're not Apple. We're somebody else who you can maybe get a good deal with.
I think Amazon's benefiting from that phenomenon, isn't
precisely
it?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's never really said explicitly in the negotiations, but there's definitely the requirement from the majors there to and also the other labels to have a variety of offerings, try different things. So it has helped us in some respect, although it's not really that explicitly said. But yeah, they are different business. They are into selling hardware, and we are really about the music.
As we've discussed, digitization of music has dramatically affected how we use it, and we've spent a lot of time in this podcast discussing the benefits. But what have been the unforeseen effects?
Music and technology have always gone hand in hand. You know, a piano is a piece of technology. So digitization, or whatever you want to call it, is another technology, another format. But fundamentally, as we said before, artists make music, fans listen to it, and everyone in between tries to help in that process.
Ian, what would you say is the most important technological revolution in the past 50 years?
The internet.
Hooray for the web.
The interweb.
It's pretty unassailably the number one, right? Yeah. It's impossible to think of anything that's had a bigger impact upon music.
The
from
mini disc
a...
player.
I think the biggest impact outside of the web for me is actually live music reproduction technology and all the stuff that's happened on the live music sound, because the only reason that live music has done so well is not because the artists have got any better at playing their instruments. In fact, you might argue the opposite in some cases. I think it's a lot to do with the fact that now you can go to a gig and it sounds pretty good, whereas even 10, 15 years ago, you were going to gigs and they were sounding terrible.
And that's, you know, a hugely bigger financial opportunity for the band if they can play, you know, arena tours rather than, you know, toilet tours.
And also that live music only really works when you're there, because those sort of albums of when somebody played in Seattle, I just think they always sound a bit naff.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, I was listening to a live recording of the Velvet Underground in New York the other day, and it was such a cool, he was singing like "I'm Waiting for My Man," right? You know that bit where he's talking about going up to Lexington to buy drugs? And I was just thinking, it sounds like a grimy little club in New York. And he's talking about going to buy drugs in New York. And clearly when this gig ends, they're all going to go and buy drugs in New York. And you can hear it all on the record. And it's a really interesting sound. And it sounds a lot cooler than the album recording to me. So
okay,
we'll see a lot of growth in that area.
But conversely, digitization has been negative as well. Look, for example, at how many indie record stores are going out of business.
This is all about the recorded music industry though, right? We're very specifically talking about recorded music here. It is a subset of the overall music industry. I think Fred's made the point very well that, you know, what it's requiring it to kind of boil it down to nothing and then start again. And I think now record companies are successfully doing that.
Yeah. Obviously, digitization in that respect, if we want to focus in on that, has had a series of knock-on effects, you know, because if you buy the idea that it's driven down the notion of a unit of music, then anyone selling units of music, i.e. record stores, but that includes Tower Records in the US, which isn't exactly your local kind of convenience store. So music is disappearing from the high street, which is sad, because we can all, presumably, we're all of the generation where we can talk about the first record that we bought and where we bought it and spending our pocket money on that sort of thing. That's all going away. But again, you know, kids now don't see that as a problem necessarily. We see that as a problem because we're the generation on the cusp. They don't give a shit. I mean, they just look at you. If you say to them, "Isn't it sad that you can't go buy a record?" They'll just look at you and say, "Hey, Grandpa, what's your problem?"
I mean, kids these days.
So
they have,
you know,
no respect.
The problem is that we're on a generational shift. We're young enough to get the new technology. We're old enough to not really understand what kids are doing. And actually, I'm amazed at what they're doing.
I can totally relate to what Fred's saying about going to the record store and having that guy there who knows you and who knows the records you want to buy. And it's a real shame that that's going away. And I think that somebody needs to innovate and create a way for people who have more information about what music is good and more, you know, the guy in the record store who just spent 30 years listening to records, give them a way to make money from that information. And I know there's one in London, actually, called People's Music Store.
Yeah.
And they're trying to create a way for experts to basically take a cut of the music they're helping to sell. So I think that's a really interesting model as well for the future.
Well, that's all for this week. And we hope it's been music to your ears. Oh, you knew I had to say that. Many thanks to all of our guests, Fred Bolza, Ian Hogarth, and Ben Perot, and of course, the lovely Jemima Kish. Next week, we're up in Newcastle, finding out what the Northeast has to offer in the technology sector. In the meantime, I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next Tuesday.